available to our patients with severe factor VIII deficiency and inhibitors. And everyone who is eligible for and needs Hemlibra has had that offered to them at this point. So I suppose the real question is, what is happening for 2019 and on into 2020? And I don't need to tell, I know you've had a really good discussion earlier today about how better treatments are helping to change the reality of the lived experience of people with haemophilia. I think everyone is aware of the fact that nowadays an infant who is born with haemophilia has the same life expectancy as the average person, certainly in the US and the same in Europe. And that has been a big change, and particularly there's been great improvement since the 1990s. And coming along with that idea that, you know, people have the same quantity of life, we also want people to have the same quality of life. So there's changing expectations, and I know you had a discussion about that this morning too, which is that people with haemophilia now can expect not to have any bleeds or to have very few bleeds. And that has implications for their choices in relation to work and education. So no longer are occupations, for example, that have, you know, potentially are more physically demanding, no longer are they excluded for people who have bleeding disorders. People can participate in sports and activities. Now, whether that is a kickabout with the kids in the park or whether it is to be one of the leading footballers in the country, it's up to yourselves whether you think the fellas in blue or the fellas in green and gold are the leading footballers. I actually met some of the Dublin football team this morning, would you believe? I came to my daughter's training this morning as a special treat with the Sam Maguire, not to rub it in. And I have to say, besides being amazing athletes, they're also lovely people, just saying. And then finally, I suppose we're all aware that people with haemophilia can actually now aspire to doing anything that they want to do. So we'll know that Chris Bombardier is summited Everest. And I think, you know, increasingly we're seeing people in the community saying, I would like to do that, or I would like to do something similar. And it's about being able to really look to achieving that and feeling that there's no barrier. The problem is that there are a few barriers still, I think. And if we look at, and I know people have heard me say this before, but just to sort of summarise where we're at with the unmet needs for haemophilia. First of all, we know that people are still at risk of bleeding even when they're on extended half-life factor concentrates. And the reason is that we just can't give people enough factor to give them trough levels that would be needed to prevent bleeding. And I'm talking about trough levels probably of the order of 10 and 15%. And the difficulty there is that you'd have to give factor so frequently and at such doses that it's just totally impractical to think that factor infusions could give us factor levels that would be protective, really. You know, maybe there'll be developments in that sphere in the future, but certainly even with EHLs at the moment, really we cannot give you the trough levels that you'd need. And we know that if you want to be bleed-free, you need to spend very little time, less than 1%. And so studies have shown this over the years. And also that level of protection is about 10 or 15%. Can't get there. Even with really good prophylaxis, we know that some people will develop joint disease. So this is a very famous graph from a study a few years back on kids on prophylaxis, showing that even if people had very few clinically evident joint bleeds, some of those kids had a very high score on their MRI scans. So if you just want to see over here, so these are the people down here with very few obvious bleeds, but some of those kids have very high MRI scores. So what's happening is that there's damage occurring even without the child or their parent being aware that there had been a bleed. And looking at a country like Germany, where they've always had loads of prophylaxis, when they look at people with haemophilia, even at a young age, you're beginning to see that joint disease is occurring in the common joints that are affected, like the ankles, even at the age of 10. So despite access to prophylaxis, and we're lucky here in Ireland, we do have access to good prophylaxis, but even good prophylaxis isn't fully protective. And that is not even to take into account the fact that this intravenous administration route is such a problem. And it's a problem at all stages of life, from small infants and children to adolescents and teens going to college to people older in older years who find maybe perhaps that it's not so easy for them to access their veins. So one way or another, while factor VIII prophylaxis and factor IX prophylaxis are amazing and we're so happy to be able to have those treatments available to us, it's not going to be the full picture. And so that brings me on then to, I suppose, a number of treatments, but particularly focusing on a treatment called emicizumab or Hemlibra. And again, everyone here probably has heard of Hemlibra, but I'm just going to go through a little bit of what it is and how it works, just in case people aren't totally up to date on it. So what is Hemlibra? Well, Heme Libre is a manufactured antibody that binds to clotting factors and helps them work. So it is, if you like, this is a sort of a cartoon of it. So this is the manufactured synthetic antibody that has been made and designed so that it can bind on the one side to clotting factor 10 and on the other side to activated factor 9. So we all have factor 10, and it's a really important clotting factor protein because it drives the generation of something called thrombin, and that helps to stop the bleeding if you get an injury or you have a trauma. And the important thing to know is that this manufactured synthetic antibody is the same as what we have in our bodies already, something called immunoglobulin that helps us to fight infection. So it's not a new protein to the body. And this kind of medicine is already used very widely, for example, in cancer treatment and in lots of inflammatory conditions like bowel inflammation and rheumatoid arthritis. So again, it's a technology that's already been well tried in lots of other disease areas. And so how does it work in comparison to regular factor VIII? Well, this is a picture of what regular factor VIII is doing in the clotting system. So it's binding here to factor 10 and activated factor 9, and it literally physically brings them together, and it allows then this factor 9 to activate factor 10, and then factor 10 can go on and make the thrombin that we need. And how Heme Libre works is it does the same thing. So it sits in the middle of these two clotting proteins, brings them together, and that generates the activated factor 10 that we all need to stop bleeding. There are a few differences, though, and I won't go into the science of it too much, except to say that one of the important things is that factor VIII has a lot of strong connections to those two clotting factors, factor VIII, factor 10 and factor 9A. And Heme Libre, while it does bind these two, it actually binds with a sort of a weaker connection. And why that's important is that if we needed then to give factor VIII to somebody because maybe they were having a surgery or maybe because they fell and had an accident, what we know is that if factor VIII is infused, it will push the Heme Libre out of the equation. So it supplants or takes over from the Heme Libre. So in a way, Heme Libre works when you've no factor VIII there, but once you start infusing some factor VIII, the Heme Libre gets pushed aside. And that's useful for us because Heme Libre is not a treatment for acute bleeding, it's a treatment to prevent bleeding. It's a prophylactic treatment. And it's given by subcutaneous injection, so instead of having to find a vein, you can actually inject at any point on your tummy, on your thighs, or even on the edge of your arm, and you just pinch an inch, if anyone here can, and you pop the little small needle in and just inject the treatment. I think some people here will have maybe used some subcutaneous treatments in the past, so you'll know that it's actually much easier maybe than trying to find a vein. Can be a little bit uncomfortable, so depending on how much you have to inject, you can get a little bit of a burning. I had a bit of insight recently because I had to get an injection of heparin, just one dose, and my goodness, it was uncomfortable. So yeah, I have a newfound respect actually. So it's a subcutaneous injection, and you can give it once a week, or you can give it once a fortnight, or you can even give it once a month. But what those who are good at maths will know that actually it's the same dose, so it's effectively the same amount no matter whether you give it weekly, fortnightly, or every month. And so the next thing that people might wonder is, you'll know that when you give a factor infusion, the level goes up very high, and then it begins to be cleared quite quickly. And so you'll know that there are times when you've got levels that are quite good, and then other times when maybe you're close to your trough level. And so the point about Heme Libre is when you give an injection of this antibody, it stays in the system for about 3 to 4 weeks, actually. So the half-life of factor VIII, even the Elocta, the half-life is about 15 hours, maybe 15 to 18 hours. The half-life of this is 3 to 4 weeks. So once it gets up into the levels, whether you're on weekly, fortnightly, or monthly, the levels, as you can see, stay very, very steady. So there's no idea that the levels go up and down. However, if you stop taking Heme Libre, it can take up to 6 months for it to fully clear from your system for the same reason. And once you've given it as a subcutaneous injection, you can't go in and take it back out again. Some people might wonder whether you need to measure the drug levels, but again, you know, there's no need to measure the levels because actually they stay very steady all the time. So who can have treatment with this Heme Libre? So the first thing to say is it's only for people with factor VIII deficiency, unfortunately. So if you've got factor IX deficiency, this is not going to be suitable treatment for you. I already mentioned that it's for prevention of bleeding. So it is something to be taken on a weekly, fortnightly or monthly basis that will stop you bleeding when you're running around playing sport or doing your activities. But if you have an injury or need a surgery, as I've mentioned earlier, you will still be getting Elocta. And the good news is it can be used if inhibitors are present. So that has obviously always been a real problem for us. And we've been able to give this treatment to a number of people with inhibitors over the last 12 months. And I would have to say that really, I think, and I know people in this room will probably speak to this, but it has certainly, I think, been very, very effective at preventing bleeding in people with factor VIII deficiency in inhibitors. So I suppose the next question is, well, what studies have been done to kind of figure out how to use this? And we've had four main phase three studies. There's obviously been phase one, two studies earlier on. So they've called them the Haven studies, and just because you'll hear maybe those names used. So Haven 1 is for severe hemophilia A patients with inhibitors. Haven 2 is for pediatric patients with inhibitors. Haven 3 is for non-inhibitor patients. And Haven 4 was a smaller study to look at every four-week dosing. And we've been lucky here in Ireland because we've actually had four patients who've been enrolled in the Haven 3 study. These are four people without inhibitors, and they've been participating in that study over the last 2.5 years. So what's been good there is not alone have we been able to hear the results of these studies as they're coming through, but we've had hands-on experience right here in Ireland of giving treatment, which is Hemlibra, to non-inhibitor patients. So we feel we've got a good handle on the issues as we've gone through that. So I'll just skip through that. So just very briefly, just to say that both of the Haven 1 and Haven 3 studies have been published, both in the New England Journal of Medicine. So this is in 2017. And if you just look at this group here, so these are people with inhibitors with no prophylaxis. So the blue bar is people who had no treatment, and that's the bleed rate, and coming way down when people are on Hemlibra. And equally, we saw the same picture with the non-inhibitor patients. If you were on on-demand treatment, you had nearly 40 bleeds, whereas if you were either on weekly, two-weekly, or you had prior prophylaxis, very low annualized bleed rates, and over half of those folks had no bleeds at all. So this is coming back to what we were talking about earlier, that really where we should be trying to get to in haemophilia is no bleeds. So there was an update at the ISTH meeting that was held in July, and so there were two important updates. One was about management of surgery, because that's always a worry for people is, okay, I'm taking this treatment and I'm not having bleeding on a day-to-day basis, but what happens when I need a surgery? And so it was very useful because they presented all of the surgery data from those four Haven studies. And this is a slide looking at the minor procedures, of which there were 141. Okay, so across the four studies, and they were the usual kinds of procedures anybody here might have to undergo, a dental procedure. A good few people were getting their ports out, which is great. Scopes or joint injections would be very common ones as well. And what was really important here was that two-thirds of those minor procedures were done without factor, and 90% of those had no bleeding. So this goes to show, I think, that one of the things we've sort of learned as we've gone along with Hemlibra is that it gives fantastic protection against bleeds, but actually it gives enough protection that you can do a lot of minor procedures without having to give anything extra. Now, if you feel you need to give something extra, there's no problem. We give Elocta and it works beautifully. But I think as time goes on, we probably will be less inclined to maybe give Elocta as well, particularly for the more minor procedures, like, for example, a scope or something like that. Indeed, in the four Haven studies, they also managed some major surgeries without extra prophylactic factor. I'm not sure I'm ready to go that far yet, but they reported 18 surgeries, of which three had no factor and didn't have any bleeding. Now, the three were a synovectomy, an open reduction fracture, and a muscle suture. So they weren't exactly a total knee replacement or anything like that. But I think what's interesting is that, look, I think the reality is that we will still be using Elocta, but we will primarily, I think, be using Elocta for people having really major surgeries. Now, the other really important piece of update information was that they looked at the long-term follow-up for the people in all of those four studies. So this graph shows these are the Haven 1 folks, who are the people with inhibitors. This is the Haven 2, which is the children with inhibitors. This is Haven 3, which is people without inhibitors. And this is the Haven 4, which is a newer study, which is why there isn't as much follow-up. And this follows out to 96 weeks. And as time has gone on for each of the four studies, this large blue bar has started to increase. And the blue bar is the people with no bleeds. So as time has gone on in Haven 1, there's an increase in the people with no bleeds, same in Haven 2, same in Haven 3, and same in Haven 4. So there is an idea that if we can control the inflammation within joints, that that makes it less likely that you'll have more bleeds in the future, which sort of stands to reason, but it's fantastic to see it proven. And then the other really important thing is that if you were unlucky enough to have a target joint, now a target joint is defined as a joint in which you've had 3 bleeds in 6 months, but if you were unlucky enough to have one of those and you were on emicizumab, they were all resolved effectively. So if you had a target joint and you went on Hemlibra, the target joint resolved. So that was really, encouraging, reassuring information that showed that even as time went on these studies, that people continued to do even better. So then the next question is, well, you know, if it sounds too good to be true, maybe it is. So the question is, has there been any side effects? So by far the most common side effect is a little reaction at the injection site. That's usually redness or a little bit of discomfort around the injection site. That's common enough, actually. And funnily enough, you know, people can get a reaction with today's injection and not with tomorrow's injection. It just doesn't seem to be particularly, there isn't much of a pattern to it. But they're temporary. They don't need treatment. And they really generally don't mean that people have to stop treatment. I think the biggest and most important side effects are the side effects of thrombosis, which is clotting too much in a way. That's what we're trying to prevent. And another complication called thrombotic microangiopathy, or TMA. Now, I suppose we've known that treatments for haemophilia can cause clotting. Particularly people who have inhibitors have encountered this over the years because, you know, FEBA treatment and 7A have always been known to be potentially able to cause clotting. I suppose this was the first maybe direct sort of prophylactic treatment for non-inhibitor patients as well that could cause thrombosis. There definitely was a link between thrombosis and FEBA treatment at higher doses. So I think that was one of the learnings, is that if we gave people FEBA, which contains factor 10, obviously that's what we call a substrate for emicizumab or Hemlibra. Hemlibra binds to it, and if we added in extra factor 10, that seems to have been a problem. So in the clinical trials, there were some thrombosis, 2 in total, that were linked to having higher doses of FEBA. And what I can say is that all of the cases of TMA, of which there were 5 in total across the clinical studies and post-authorization studies, they were all linked to FEBA. But there were a number of thrombosis reported since the clinical trials that are not definitely related to FEBA, but might have been related to people's other risk factors. So, for example, if you were a smoker, or if you were, you know, overweight, or you had a family history of arterial disease, that there may be some link there. So I think we just need to be aware of that and taking into account, number one, the person's personal medical history and maybe their family medical history, and really trying to manage those risk factors for arterial clots in particular, like blood pressure, sugar levels, cholesterol levels, etc. I think that's something that we all need to be looking at anyway, and I know you've heard this from me and from others before, is that I think people with haemophilia now, particularly as they are maybe going into later years, need to understand that they're not immune from these other clotting complications. And I suppose the other point is that we would not now give FEBA to somebody who was on Hemlibra at all. Now, the other, side effect that has been reported is something called anti-drug antibodies. Now, people in this community will understand that if you give a protein, which is a foreign protein, then the immune system can react to it, and that's what happens when people have inhibitors, for example. Small numbers of people developed these anti-drug antibodies in the trials, and in fact, actually, one person even had them before they entered the trial. So sometimes we have these little antibodies that develop that can be cross-reactive. I would say that they have not been a problem in the phase 3 trials. They were originally reported in the phase 1 trial. And in the earlier trials, they didn't cause any problem with the efficacy or the way that Hemlibra works. But there was one pediatric patient in the Haven 2 trial who developed these anti-drug antibodies very shortly after they started Hemlibra, and it did reduce the effectiveness of Hemlibra, and that person stopped the treatment. That's the only person I'm aware of at this time, but I think it's something that we all just need to be aware of. And I think what it does sort of emphasise is that even though we know a lot about this treatment, it's been very extensively studied, still in all, when we use drugs in the real world, as we call it, things can happen. People who participate in clinical trials are very carefully selected, and some people who perhaps had other risk factors for clotting, maybe, for example, wouldn't have been eligible. So as we begin to use this outside of clinical trials, I think we need to be really careful to be on the lookout for any unusual reactions or events. And I think that's where we really, number one, commend everybody here and in the wider community who's really worked with us since we switched, for example, to Elocta and Alprolix, have really been good partners, have come to clinic, have scanned their treatment and helped us to make sure that there's nothing untoward happening. And absolutely, even more so, I think we'll have to do that with new treatments like Hemlibra. So a further question might be, what lab tests are used then? I mean, we've heard about maybe some side effects and whatever. What can we use to monitor the treatment? There's a couple of important things to know. Our screening blood test is called the APTT. That's a common screening blood test that's done in lots of hospitals. That'll become very short for somebody on Hemlibra, so it'll look almost subnormally low. And it might actually make someone who doesn't know think that actually coagulation is normal, but it isn't. And so this is just an example saying no matter which of the different kinds of tests that you use, where somebody with no treatment would have an APTT of about 120 seconds, it's right down to kind of, you know, maybe 25, 28 seconds with some of the lab tests. So it's important that people who take Hemlibra are aware of this, particularly if they go to a hospital which isn't their usual centre. The next thing to know is that if you're measuring the factor 8 level by our usual factor 8 test, you'll get the wrong answer. So if you measure it, you will get a level of 300-400%, which is rubbish. It's nonsense. It's, you know, it's not true. People have gotten caught out with this. So I know that one of my colleagues in the US, he had a local hematologist who was seeing an inhibitor patient who rang up saying, oh, my God, it's amazing. Little Johnny's levels are 300%. He said, little Johnny's levels are not 300%. So we must not use that factor level, and we must use one called a chromogenic method. So we know that in St. James's, and we know who's on Hemlibra. And if we're giving Elocta, we can measure the factor 8 we infuse quite well, quite accurately, no problem. It's just that we must use this chromogenic version, not the usual version. And so the real kind of message is that for people who are on Hemlibra, your healthcare providers, and by whom I mean people who might be in an emergency department somewhere, they need to know what you're taking, and there is an alert card that explains all of that, and it's important that people on Hemlibra would carry that. Now, one thing that cropped up in about the last 10 days has been some reports of particles being found in vials of Hemlibra, and some people might have seen this. The EHC has come out on its website to talk about this. So the first thing to know is that all protein-containing medicines can have particles, including factor concentrates and including many of those antibody treatments I mentioned earlier for treatment of cancer patients and rheumatoid arthritis patients and so on. It's particularly an issue if you're giving the drug intravenously, because obviously if you directly put a particle into the bloodstream, it can clog up the little blood vessels, particularly in the lungs. So for a subcutaneous medicine, it's not such an issue because the treatment is going to sit in the subcutaneous tissues and it's not going to go into the bloodstream. But still in all, obviously, people want to know what it's all about. So what transpired was that the company reported to the various regulatory authorities earlier this year that they'd found some particles initially in one batch of Hemlibra, and later they did some more sort of extensive testing and found that they were present in all vials. They've said to us that the particles have been tested and that they consist of a mixture of the protein, which is emicizumab, and silicone oil, which is used as part of the manufacturing in this medicine and lots of other medicines. The EMA, FDA, the Japanese authorities, the Swiss authorities, they've all looked at the evidence and they have decided that it's not a safety concern. But there is a final report that's gone to the EMA at the end of September, and I suppose we're all just waiting to see, does the EMA say to Roche that they should change their manufacturing process? So there's been some discussion about whether they might try and change the process to take some of that silicone oil out of the process. But whether they do or they don't, I think we're all quite comfortable that this doesn't mean it's a reason to not have the treatment. But it was a little bit of a curveball, I would have to say, in the last 10 days, and we certainly hadn't been expecting it. And I suppose the other thing was that it wasn't communicated particularly well. So I think the community and the patient community heard first. The treating community were only informed officially and formally at the end of this week just gone by. I participate in the clinical trial, as I mentioned, and also in the... I prescribe it for patients commercially here in Ireland. So we weren't happy about how the communication process was handled, but we have met with Roche here in Ireland. So as you'll all be aware, the Product Selection Board are responsible for both choosing the treatments that are made available for people with haemophilia in Ireland, but also in monitoring the safety of those treatments. So the board did meet with the company this week, and I think it's fair to say that the company aren't in any doubt that we do not feel that this is the appropriate level and kind of communication we'd expect for this sort of issue. I suppose the problem is it falls into a grey area because it's not a safety issue. They'd have to report a safety issue to us immediately. But unfortunately, because it fell into this sort of little grey zone around, well, it's really about manufacturing process, that's why they felt that they didn't need to tell us. But of course, obviously we would feel that they did. So... having said all of that, the next question is, well, when will HemeLabor be available for non-inhibitor patients? So I suppose the good news story for today is that the contracts were signed this week. And I'm pleased that Norman Latham is here. He's our head of procurement in St. James's. He participates with Brian and myself and Declan on the product selection committee. And, there's been a lot of work done, especially from our colleagues in procurement, both Norman and his colleague, David Gunning, to really support us, not only in this treatment, actually, but in all of the treatments that are made available for people with haemophilia in Ireland. And we're very grateful to them because they have an expertise, obviously, that we don't have. And we're very happy to have that available to us. But it's teamwork, so I think it's fair to say that our patient community, our treating community, and our hospital and Department of Health community have really come together on this one, as we have done in previous times. So what's important for people to know is that the delivery method that you're used to and that you rely on from TCP stays the same, so the treatment gets delivered just the same. And you'll also be delighted to know that the scanning is exactly the same. So we're, I have to say this because Evelyn Singleton will kill me if I do not, to say that it's just so important that we... with you are keeping an eye on who's taking what treatment, when are they taking it, particularly if any little problems developed or issues arose, that we can just see exactly what's been happening and when have you been taking your treatment and so on. So that is just really so important for us. That's the first thing. And the second thing is just not to forget that the scanning is really also a safety precaution. So if you scan your treatment before you give it, and if some little issue has arisen, I'm not talking about the particle issue now, but if something else arose and it was a safety problem and not a quality problem, then your app will tell you, no, hang on, there's a problem here, the centre doesn't want you to give this treatment. And so I really would encourage people enormously to scan first and treat after, because then you can really give your treatment in the confidence that actually this is good to go, you have a green light to give the treatment today. So that's the other thing just to really remember about the scanning. People won't be taken off Elocta. So I mentioned that Elocta will still be needed for injuries, for surgeries, so you'll still be on Elocta for those sorts of scenarios. So in a way, there isn't a kind of a mad rush to have to change. What we want to try and do with this switchover is, number one, we want to try and focus on people who we know have a genuine immediate clinical need. So we have people in the community who are still having terrible breakthrough bleeds despite their prophylaxis. We have people in the community who can't access their veins or find it really, really challenging. And so as a treating community, we feel it's important that we try and focus on those folks first, and that then we roll it out accordingly to whoever wants it. I would have to say that it is going to be available to whoever wants it. So that one of the things that was really important for us when we were trying to get this treatment available was I didn't want to have to sit in the clinic and go, well, you can have it and you can't. Who do I like this week? Who do I not like this week? So the point is that if people come and talk to us and feel that it's the right treatment for them and wish to have it, then you will be able to have it. But I don't want everyone turning up on Monday morning at 9 o'clock going, hi, I'm ready for my HemeLibra. So if you can just have a tiny bit of patience with us, we will work through things with every single person who's interested. So as I've mentioned, everyone will have an opportunity to discuss and consider HemeLibra and decide if it's for them or not. But remember, It's fine to stay with your current treatment if you feel you're doing well on Elocta, if it isn't a great burden for you, if you feel confident in your treatment, there is no difficulty. We still have Elocta available, and we'll always have Elocta or something similar available. So please don't feel that you're under any pressure to change. I know that there are, you know, we're made in different ways as humans. There are people who are mad keen for something new, and then others who like to stay back and see what happens, and that is totally okay. And as I mentioned, Elocta will still be used. I think there probably is something around a discussion with individual people about whether they even need to have any Elocta at home. So one of the things that we've, I suppose, experienced over the last 2 years with our clinical trial patients is that as time has gone on, their factor VIII concentrate is getting dusty from, you know, not being needed. And it's expiring, and then obviously we can't use it. And, you know, we're very keen to avoid wastage if we can. So depending on the person's individual clinical circumstances, I think there probably is something around, you know, if you lived very close to the hospital, for example, you might feel, well, I'll use up all my Elocta and I won't need to keep any treatment at home. Alternatively, if you lived a far distance from the hospital, or if you were someone who was kind of anxious about this new treatment, don't worry, it will be fine for you to keep a dose of Elocta at home. So I think we can work that through with each individual person as time goes on. And so what I'd say to people for the moment is keep an eye on the IHS website. So we'll be putting any updates around the rollout of this treatment up there, and also have a chat to us either at your clinic visit or give the clinical nurse specialists a buzz if you wish to. So, you know, I think we'll be having lots of conversations with lots of people over the next while about this treatment, about whether it is something that they are interested in having. We will, of course, though, need to work through our stocks of Elocta as well. So, as I say, it's not a question of changing next week. So I'm going to change tack a smidgen now, and I'm just going to talk to you about something called the National Haemophilia Lighthouse Project. You'll have heard about that before, because the patient organisation here has been very involved in working with us all on this project. And this was supported by the HSE. We were one of three Lighthouse projects, and the idea of this one was to replace our electronic health record. So we've had an electronic health record for bleeding disorders and haemophilia since 2006, and we share it across the different haemophilia centres. So ourselves, Crumlin, Cork and Galway all have access into this health record. And it's a really important safety measure for patients, because it means that no matter who rings me at 2 in the morning from Roscommon or wherever, I can actually see exactly what the diagnosis is, the treatment of choice, and all of the important safety information that I might need to make a good decision, no matter what time of day or night. And so I suppose it hasn't been without its hiccups. So in fact, actually, the project was initiated way back in the end of 2017, so we're almost 2 years at it now. We did a fair amount of work in the early part of 2018 to begin to, you know, map out what was going to be involved in moving all the information from our old system to our new system. We then hit a little, I suppose speed bump is too small a word for it, as Norman will know, but there were some technical issues, contractual issues, and that took us quite a long time to sort out. And again, I'd like to acknowledge Norman's participation in that. So for really a lot of 2018, we had to divert our attention to sorting those out in order to be able to get back on track, which we did. So we got back on track in the early part of 2019, and so with the partners in Valentia Technologies, the teams in the various haemophilia centres have done an enormous amount of work over the last 9 months to really map all of our processes, our data, and make sure that we can move all of our information from ClinTech to our new Indici system. And I'm pleased to report that the go live date was last Monday. So before we did that, as I've mentioned, we had to map all of our information, write a script. Now, don't ask me what that is, because I'm telling you, I couldn't tell you. But it moved all the information from one system to the other, and we had to make sure that it was all correct and validated and verified, which we have done. And then the other thing we had to do is, in St. James's at least, our system interacts with our lab system, interacts with the home scan system, interacts with our patient administration system, and all of those interfaces, as they're called, had to be replicated and verified. We also did a lot of work with our HSE colleagues around the governance of the system. Now, GDPR came in, as we all know, and it's really important to make sure that all of our processes are absolutely correct to protect people's information and privacy. So naturally the HSC and ourselves were very keen to work closely on that. And the other thing is we did a lot, so this is called the PIA, a privacy impact assessment. So an external body came in and did what we call a privacy impact assessment. So really reviewed the system to see how are we managing people's information and are we doing it correctly. And the other thing that was done was something called penetration testing, which is where an outside company tried to hack into the system and made sure that it was absolutely secure and that it could not be, if you like, breached. So we've had good reassurances on both of those. And so we went live. Originally, it was due on the 21st. This must be the first IT project ever that went 7 days early on go live. So go live is October. So that was for release one. Now, the purpose of release one was to replicate what we already had. But there are more developments to come. So what we're expecting in release two in May 2020 is that we'll have additional features. We'll have a patient portal, which I'll tell you about in a little bit. We'll have more interfacing for Crumlin and Cork particularly, who don't have good interfaces now. And we'll have a dental module, which we'll have to work with Alison on, because we really need to try and move dental record keeping from paper into electronic. And then the final release will be in November 2020. This is a few pictures of how it looks. This is from the test system, so nobody's going to be surprised to see their own data up here. These are not real people. So this is what happens. I open it up and I can see, for example, these are all the jobs that other people in the team want me to do. So I imagine that as time goes on, that list will just get bigger and bigger. And we can go into a patient record and we'll get alerts, for example, it doesn't come out very well, but things like special precautions, you know, any particular issues about patients will flash up for us immediately we open it. But one particularly important sort of part of the screen is things like their primary diagnosis, their treatment of choice, allergies and alerts. So all very visible on the top screen of our patient record. And then we can use these little tabs down here to navigate to things like people's letters, people's lab results and so forth and so on. They've even already, I have to say, Valentian Technologies have worked really well with us, because all they were obliged to do on this release was to give us what we had already, but they've given us things that we wanted that we didn't have. So the ISDH have come out with a bleeding assessment tool a number of years back, and we're very keen to use that for all of our new patients. And so they've given us that into the system electronically. They've put things like the HJHS in there. And another thing they've given us is an actual measurement of the annualised bleed rate, which, funny, you'd be surprised to hear this, but we didn't have this in ClinTech. So already they've given us things that we didn't have. We do have medication records in here, so we'll be able to see people's haemophilia treatment, and when you scan, it'll come straight into your record. So I suppose the aims for the Lighthouse project were to replace the current system, and the problem was that it was going down quite regularly, so we were really unhappy that it was going to go one of these days and it wasn't going to start up again. We agreed that we would retain everything that we currently have, so important information like their diagnosis and treatment of choice, that we'd have visibility across the four centres, that all of the MDT could access the info, and that we'd have outcome measures like bleeding rates and joint scores. And then the next phase is going to be enhancing things. So getting better analysis of our data, reliable data, governance and data protection, and I mentioned the patient portal. So a patient portal is a secure online website that gives people access to their own treatment. And to me, actually, that's just a no-brainer. This is about individual people who attend our service. And the people who need to know that info are you, the people whose information it is. But clearly, obviously, we want to do that in a way that's planned, in a way that's safe. As I've mentioned, privacy is such an important thing for us. But what we hope we'll be able to do is... Now, don't hold me to this slide, right? So this is what we're hoping to do, but I'm not, you know, we'll have to see, obviously, can we do everything that we want to do. But what we'd like to do is be able to have an integrated electronic patient record. We want to be able to give people relevant education. So if you're having a surgery on your knee, for example, that you get info to do with knee surgery. And if you're a youngster who's playing sports, that maybe you get information that's relevant to that. That we, you know, we put, I suppose, our money where our mouth is in terms of making the patient the centre of what we do, so that in a way people can contribute to their own records, feel an ownership over their own records, maybe use some of the technologies that are available out there at the moment, have their health record available to them if they go and see their GP, if they go to another hospital. I'm amused that the parking is here, because obviously, as you all know, there is no parking in St. James's. I can't say I can promise to fix that. What we aspire to be able to do, again, we'll have to see how well it'll work in practice, is that people will be able to book their own appointments and, you know, pick an appointment that suits them. and upload stuff from their Fitbits or their Apple Watches, and ultimately maybe even do direct video consultations so that you won't have to schlep up to St. James's to see us, but actually you can arrange to see us remotely if you need to. So in the end of the day, I suppose the key things are going to be that it's online and it's easily accessible, that it's secure, number one, that you have 24/7 access to your records, and that you'll have a system that's responsive every time there's something new. So I think, from my own perspective, I think we hope the future is bright. I just want to acknowledge really all of the contribution really of every single person who attends our service, whether they are actively involved, say, in the committees of the patient organisation or whether they're giving us feedback in the clinic. It's all so important to us to try and make things better, and particularly, obviously, our teams, our clinical research teams, our MDT, and here's a few of them here, smiling faces in St. James's. So thank you very much for your attention.